On a quiet September night in 1961, a seemingly routine drive through the New Hampshire wilderness became the cornerstone of a mystery that would captivate the world. What began as a strange light in the sky ended in missing time, bizarre memories, and the birth of a phenomenon, alien abduction. This is the story of Betty and Barney Hill. In this episode, we dive into the mysterious and groundbreaking story of Betty and Barney Hill, the ordinary couple whose 1961 encounter in New Hampshire's White Mountains became the first widely publicized alien abduction case. From their eerie close encounter with a strange craft to the vivid, haunting memories revealed under hypnosis, the Hills' tales set the stage for modern UFO lore. We unravel the evidence, explore their chilling recollections, and examine the psychological and cultural forces at play. Was it an extraterrestrial encounter or something closer to home? Join us as we uncover the story that forever changed how we think about life beyond Earth. This is Scarlet Tavern.
Oof. I hit the spot.
Yeah. All right.
There's no way we can do this episode sober, so let's get to it.
I could.
Yeah.
I wrote it sober.
New sound. So hopefully we sound much better. New podcasting equipment. Like, we're real podcasters, guys.
Oh, my God. I sound great.
I feel like a real podcaster with a microphone right in my face.
So.
You guys can actually hear me when I don't, because I don't talk very loud.
I want to apologize for my voice. I am getting over whatever this is, and I am still have a little bit of a cough, but we're going to be making fun of this a lot. Betty and Barney Hill are a piece of work. I don't believe one thing that they said. So, okay, here we go. To truly understand the significance of Betty and Barney Hill's story, we need to go beyond the UFO narrative and delve into who they were as people. Betty and Barney were, by all accounts, an ordinary couple navigating the complexities of mid-20th century America. However, their backgrounds, personalities, and life experiences offer critical context for understanding the events that unfolded on that September night in 1961. Betty, born Eunice Barrett, I would change my name to Betty too, in 1919, was a passionate and determined individual. She earned her degree in social work from the University of New Hampshire, a significant achievement at a time when higher education was not as accessible for women. Her career was centered on helping vulnerable populations, particularly children, as she worked for New Hampshire's child welfare system, and there was a onslaught of this, of course, when she would have been here, it would have been in the heart of the Great Depression by the time she got her degree. Mm-hmm. She's born in 1919.
Yeah.
So by the time she gets her degree, she's in the heart of the Great Depression. So you know how many kids were on the street during that time?
Oh, probably a lot.
Especially in that area, too. Betty was known for intellectual curiosity and open-mindedness. She had a natural interest in the mysteries of the universe and had already been exposed to UFO stories through media and personal anecdotes before the encounter. This openness to the unknown likely shaped how she interpreted the events of that fateful night. Barney Hill, born in 1922, was a World War II veteran who served in Europe. His military background gave him a sense of discipline and a practical, grounded perspective on life. After the war, he worked for the U.S. Postal Service, undertaking a grueling daily commute of 60 miles to provide for his family. Keep in mind, this is before they drove everywhere.
Yeah.
They were hoofing this 60 miles going to each door. Like, listen, he was a World War II vet. Now, almost every World War II vet was involved in the shit.
It depends on what he did and where he was.
All we know is he served in Europe. We don't really know. He didn't really talk about it.
Which a lot of them talked about it.
Most World War II vets don't talk about it. But unless it's to like people like us. But And unfortunately, there's not many of them left.
Unfortunately not.
Barney's involvement in the civil rights movement highlighted his commitment to equality and justice. As an active member of the NAACP and a representative of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission's local board, Barney worked tirelessly to advocate for systemic change. His background as a black man in a racially turbulent America adds an important layer to the pressures he faced during this period. Now, I want to say, and I'm just saying this because of the time, of the time period, Barney's black, Betty's white.
Oh, yeah, this is no
In this time period, this was a no-no, and we're going to talk about that.
Yes.
Like, despite the fact that most of the New England states still allowed interracial marriages, it still was not approved.
Especially him being a military veteran, those guys would have been like, what the fuck, dude?
Yeah.
So, as of 2024, there are fewer than 70,000 World War II veterans that are still alive in the United States, according to the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. This is a significant decline from the 930,000 living in 2015.
We are slowly losing America's greatest generation.
And I believe England is not that far behind.
No, they're not. Veterans too. But yeah, we're slowly losing our greatest generation. So the Hills' marriage was one of love, mutual respect, and resilience. Their relationship stood out not just because they were an interracial couple during a time of significant societal prejudice, but also because they seemed to complement each other so well. Betty was curious, outgoing, and enthusiastic about exploring new ideas, while Barney was analytical, pragmatic, and often skeptical. This balance in their personalities created an interesting dynamic that played a significant role in how they processed the events of their alleged abduction. For example, Betty's openness made her more willing to embrace the possibility of extraterrestrial involvement, while Barney's cautious nature made him more resistant to the idea at first. At first being the key word. Being an interracial couple in the early 1960s presented its own set of challenges. In New England, racial discrimination was less overt than in the South, but it still existed. The Hills...
I'm just saying, in New England back then, they wouldn't burn crosses in your backyard or necessarily lynch you, but they still make you like hell.
I can tell you from where I lived in Wisconsin, like a half hour-ish from my house was a KKK building.
I'm from Florida.
Yeah.
They were rampant in Florida.
I even imagine so.
The Hills faced subtle and not so subtle forms of prejudice in their daily lives, which likely created a baseline level of stress. The societal backdrop may have influenced their psychological state during and after their encounter, making it essential to consider the cultural pressures they had endured. Despite these challenges, the Hills were prominent members of their community in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Oh, piss off those people. Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Wow. They'll fight you for that one.
Yeah.
They can't fight. It's New Hampshire.
Yes.
What was the last thing they were involved in? The Boston Tea Party?
They do have their flag that says, "Don't tread on me."
So
that's the Getson flag.
We have that in Florida.
I don't know what flag that is. I thought it was New Hampshire's.
They like to think it's there, but it's not.
It's in Florida. It's a place you don't want to tread.
Yeah, because half the things are behind you.
Yeah. They were active in their local Unitarian Universalist Church, where they found a progressive and accepting environment that aligned with their values. Barney's civil rights work and Betty's career in social welfare showcased their commitment to making the world a better place, even in the face of adversity. Now, okay, so Universalists.
I've never actually encountered these.
We had one.
I don't really know anything about them.
We had a Universalist church in my hometown. It was a Pentecostal church that got sold and then changed to a Universalist church.
I still can't They sell in churches. And...
So.
Yeah, I actually overlooked that. I'm like, oh, it's just a different church. Okay, whatever.
No. So, I mean, technically, they're still Christian. But there are different types of universalism. So a universalist is someone who generally believes in the idea of salvation, enlightenment, or ultimate fulfillment is available to all people, regardless of their beliefs, actions, or affiliations. The specifics of universalism vary depending on the religious or philosophical context, but it broadly includes the belief that all souls will eventually achieve a positive or reconciled state no matter what. Basically, you don't have to repent. Wow. You will eventually go to heaven. Now, there's Christian universalism, which believe that all people will ultimately be saved and reconciled with God, rejecting the idea of eternal damnation. Some see hell as temporary, meant for purification rather than eternal punishment, rooted in interpretations of scripture that emphasize God's love and mercy. There is Unitarian Universalism, which we know they are. This is a modern religious movement that embraces theological pluralism, meaning members can hold a variety of spiritual beliefs. Values include reason, personal experience, social justice, and spiritual exploration. Not necessarily Christian, it incorporates ideas from many religious and secular traditions. You have philosophical and secular universalism, which is just that moral or ethical truths apply to all people, regardless of cultural background. And then there's universalism beyond Christianity. Like, actually, Hinduism and Buddhism are considered a universalist religion because they do believe that eventually everybody will attain enlightenment or liberation. So... let's see. Before their encounter, the Hills were prominent members of their community in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They were active in their...
I think I double clicked.
Yeah, you doubled it.
Whoopsie.
Wow.
I think I did this when I was like half asleep because... Wow.
This is what we get for having Pam write our episodes.
Hey.
You know that these repeat episodes are just supposed to make things better.
Okay, they're better-ish.
I'm
only human.
The Hills' background as hardworking, community-minded couple makes their story particularly compelling. They were not the type of people typically associated with fantastical claims, which adds credibility for some and a sense of tragic vulnerability for others. Their story forces us to consider how ordinary individuals can become entwined in extraordinary narratives and how their personal histories shape the interpretation of such events. By exploring who Betty and Barney Hill were beyond their abduction claim, we gain a richer understanding of the human element in their story. It's not just a tale of UFOs. It's a story of two people deeply in love, navigating a complex and often hostile world, who suddenly found themselves at the center of one of the most intriguing mysteries of the 20th century.
And I apologize if there is any more repeats. I wrote this episode a little bit ago, so I don't remember.
We'll be docking her pay. Don't worry.
We don't get paid for this shit. You get paid?
No, of course not. No, what are you talking
about? I mean, we share a bank account, so I would know.
And you're the CFO.
Well, I'm the CFO. Yeah,
she's the CFO.
I know. That's what I'm saying. She would know.
Because I would be the one that's writing you a check.
Don't worry. Once everything goes down, when revenue comes in, we'll dock the pay for the $700.
What the heck? Why would you dock my pay?
Actually, we should probably not dock any pay to pay for Cade's health bills because it sounds like he's dying.
Yeah.
But. With Betty and Barney Hill, I mean, this one, as we're about to get into actually how this happened.
It gets weird.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you right now, as somebody who's actually driven some of these back roads of New England.
You've never went to the White Mountains?
I used to, when I worked for Dunbar, I actually used to have to go into some of these areas to make long, the few, just a couple times, some of the more remote deliveries to some of these places.
I've only been to, where was it in New Hampshire? I think as far in as like Canton when we got the car.
That's right. Yeah, that's about it. That's about.
No, otherwise,
we went, no. We went into New Massachusetts on the Vermont border for our 1 year, our anniversary.
That wasn't the Vermont border.
It was the Vermont border. I remember it was the Daughters of the Revolutionary War State Park. Great state park. If you're guys, anybody's ever out in that area, highly recommend. Great camping sites. Just don't go camping when a tornado is about to hit, like we did.
That is not an experience I want to repeat. Especially when I was getting sick because of the medications they gave me.
Yes, that was an interesting anniversary, but not an altogether bad anniversary though.
All right, I want to apologize if anybody heard that coughing, because like I said, I'm trying to get over whatever this is, and
you're dying. It's okay. We accept.
I am. It's tuberculosis.
Yeah.
Okay. No. No.
Better not be.
No. I had.
No. You got to get it.
Little
right.
Funny story here.
It's aliens.
Funny story is when I was in high school, I went to Performing Arts High School, and my ballet teacher, he was Indian, by way of England. And he would cough all the time, like really hard. He was an older guy. He's still teaching there.
Ooh.
Yeah, I don't know how he's not dead yet. But he would cough and we'd be like, Mr. Hetty, are you all right? He'd go, oh, it's okay. I have TB. And we're like, are you fucking kidding me? He'd go, no, I'm serious. That's why he eats so healthy. I have TB. I have to stay alive somehow. And I mean, this man has done a lot in his life. He was part of the Russian ballet. He was part of, like, he has, and if you know dancing, the Russian ballet are like some of the best dancers in the world.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, he also used to take and, when he would eat a banana, he would take the inside and scrape the stuff off the inside of the peel and eat it.
I mean, I've seen like the TikToks of people eating the banana whole. And I'm like, yeah, ugh.
Scrape it off and go, oh, this is the best part.
How about we just acknowledge that bananas as a whole are disgusting? Yeah.
You don't want me to say my thought out loud.
Anywho, back to the crazy alien story.
So, it was the evening of September 19th, 1961. Ben remembers this day.
Yes, he does.
I really don't. And Betty and Barney Hill were returning from a spontaneous road trip to Montreal and Niagara Falls. Horrible spontaneous road trip. Hey, not Niagara Falls, Montreal.
Yeah, I'm told that place sucks. Wow, that's not a road trip. That is like... This is like a long haul vacation because that is
at least 8 hours to Niagara Falls.
From where they are,
probably like 9 to 10 from where they are.
Probably more like 6 to 7, but then going across
to Montreal
because you have to go through Southern Ontario. Yeah, no, God, that is not a quick trip.
Yeah.
Wow.
So. They were driving their 1957 Chevy Bel Air, beautiful car, through the remote winding roads of the White Mountains in New Hampshire. The couple had planned to drive through the night to reach their home in Portsmouth before an approaching storm.
Anybody from Portsmouth, I am so sorry.
Can they afford internet there?
Yes, they can afford internet there.
I would hope so. It's expensive to live there.
Doesn't mean the people are rich. Just means it's a tourist trap. You really think Floridians are rich? It's expensive to live in Florida and Orlando.
Yeah.
Nobody, trust me, nobody in Orlando is rich. The mountains were dark and still with little traffic on the road. The only sound was the hum of their car engine, underscoring their isolation of their surroundings. Betty and Barney were eager to return home, but neither could have anticipated the chain of events that would unfold over the next few hours. Doom, doom, doom. Around 10:30, just south of Lancaster, New Hampshire.
Okay, you said Lancaster, right?
I know I did. Betty noticed a bright point of light in the sky. At first, she thought it might be a falling star, but she quickly realized it was moving upward and not downward in a manner that defied natural explanation. Betty's curiosity grew as the light seemed to follow them, appearing larger and more erratic with each passing mile. Barney, who had a background in aviation as a World War II veteran and an avid plane watcher, initially dismissed it as a commercial plane or satellite. However, its unusual behavior soon began to unsettle him as well. Now, I don't think he was... he was not an aviator. Black pilot in World War II.
Would have been the Tuskegee Airmen.
And he would be more famous for that.
Yeah, he'd be a little bit... Maybe, it depends. I mean,
and it would be put broad that he was a Tuskegee Airman.
Contrary to what Hollywood would portray it, the Tuskegee Airmen, as we know, it was actually at least three different squadrons, which one of them is included as a bomber squadron. So there's quite a bit of people. Plus, the ground crews for the Tuskegee Airmen were also African American. So they were, I mean, if he was a mechanic, then he would have he would have been working with the Tuskegee Airmen. Because as far as I know, they were the only African-American aviation unit in the war.
Yeah, there's no record of what he did in the military. So he probably just liked to watch the planes.
Killed about the planes, George.
Yeah. Betty's mounting excitement convinced Barney to pull over at a scenic picnic area south of Twin Mountain. This stop allowed them to let their dog, Delcy, stretch her legs and to observe the object more closely. Delcy is the only innocent one in this.
Yeah.
Betty grabbed a pair of binoculars and studied the object in detail because they just kept binoculars in their car.
Well, they did go to Niagara Falls.
Yeah, I mean, the thing, though, back then, the Niagara Falls wasn't like we've been there. It wasn't as built up, so there used to be some actual, like, really nice scenic spots there. Now
it's ghetto. So fucking packed. Yeah, and
fucking ghetto with meth.
So many fucking people there. Ugh. Can't move around.
Or you can, but the short people get lost.
People hawking treats and drinks and
for our listeners out there, taken from a Western New York native, best time to visit the falls is
the winter.
Well, if you can stomach the cold,
because that's really cold.
The best time to visit the falls is early to middle autumn, because all the regular tourists too cold for. So you're just getting the locals doing their jogging and stuff like that.
And bring your own water food, because bottle of water, for two bottles of water, because we want one that's really freaking hot, like $10.
Yeah, it was a big markup.
Yeah, and it was like, I believe it was like Dasani.
It was Aquafina and the metal can, or in the metal cans.
Yeah.
Don't remind us. It's so nice to have plastic bags again.
Yeah. We litter them everywhere in New York.
You purposely go out to the ocean, find the turtles, and put them on them.
Hey, no, we do not.
I do the same thing with my six-pack rings.
I actually cut those.
I don't. I put them right around their heads.
Wow.
No, he doesn't. He grew up in Florida. He basically related to Aquaman.
My aunt that's listening is not listening, but my aunt's a huge turtle fan.
The turtles are so cute, except for the snappers. The snappers, stay away from.
Dare you put your hand by them?
Hell no. I'm not. I mean, I am blonde, but I'm not that blonde.
Not anymore.
Nope, not anymore. I went red. I sold my soul. So now I'm a natural. I'm a redhead now.
Should introduce Pam to the Eastern Longneck Turtle.
Hmm.
It's also called the Snake Neck Turtle.
That is a weird looking turtle.
That is a really weird turtle.
It folds its head in like sideways.
Yeah. I've seen that before. Doesn't freak me out as much as a snake does. So don't even think about it. For our listeners, I'm absolutely 100% terrified of snakes. I can't even see a picture of a snake.
Or
I'm a snake.
Thank you, guys.
So, again, she grabbed the binoculars. She described it as an odd spinning craft with multicolored lights that moved across the face of the moon. Was she just watching E.T.?
I'm looking at this. It's like, if it wasn't for the year, I would say keep watching.
No, they watched something else. It comes
Her immediate thought was that this might be a flying saucer, as her sister had claimed to have seen 1 year earlier. My first thought would be, am I at a carnival? You know, the spinning saucer ride?
Yeah, my first thought would be like...
Pretty old.
My first thought would literally be like, all right, pinch myself to see if I'm dreaming. I'm not dreaming. Well,
did I take LSD?
Yeah.
As we're going to see, might have been a thing.
Did I hallucinate this?
That's what I believe.
Am I hallucinating?
I believe they took LSD.
That or got drugged.
With LSD.
Yeah. I don't think they took it knowingly.
Probably not.
Who knows? When Barney looked through the binoculars, he tried to rationalize what he saw. He thought it could be a commercial airliner headed towards Montreal. But what unnerved him was how the object seemed to change direction without turning, and how it moved close to them with alarming speed. Barney realized this object that was a plane was not a plane.
Aliens. No, this one is aliens. Not that.
Not what?
I'm not doing it. You can't make
it. You have the hair for it now.
Okay, his hair is more orange. Mine is red. He has the Weasley orange. I did not go orange this time.
Did he also have the hand-me-down robes?
Probably.
No. The hills decided to continue their journey, but the light in the sky followed them. They moved cautiously along the U.S. Route 3, driving through Fransonio Notch, a narrow mountain pass. The light darted around, zigzagging in the sky, sometimes disappearing behind trees or mountain ridges, only to reappear moments later. Yeah. At one point, the craft passed over a signal tower on Cannon Mountain, seemed to hover near the famous rock formation known as the Old Man of the Mountain. Betty would later estimate that the craft was at least 1.5 times the length of the granite cliff face, which measured 40 feet. Or for those of you that measure wrong, it's 12 meters.
Yeah, I can't get into that.
We have freedom units. Both Betty and Barney were increasingly unsettled by the object's silent, erratic movements. Its unpredictable path seemed almost deliberate, as though it was intentionally staying within their line of sight. Approximately 1 mile south of Indian Head, the object descended rapidly towards their vehicle. Barney was forced to stop the car in the middle of the highway. As they sat frozen in their car, the object hovered silently about 80 to 100 feet above them, filling the entire windshield with its size. Barney would later describe it as resembling a huge pancake. Despite his growing fear, Barney decided to investigate further. He grabbed his pistol, tucked it into his pocket, probably like a 380.
Pancakes sound good.
We're hungry, everybody. We've been doing some work around the house today.
Yeah, rearranging the studio. Stepped out of the car to get a closer look. As he peered through the binoculars, he claimed to see humanoid figures through the windows of the craft. These figures seemed to be watching him, and their movements suggested coordination. Most appeared to communicate telepathically, warning Barney to stay where you are and keep looking. Or, sorry, to
That's really why we keep looking.
Okay, I'm sorry, but if it's 80 to 100 feet, how are they looking? Like, how is he seeing this?
That's a pretty good eyesight.
He has good eyesight. He's a military man.
Okay, you and I were military, and our eyesight is shit.
Quit pointing at me.
Actually, there's a third person that refuses to get glasses that needs glasses. I don't know about worms.
I'll get them.
So, Barney was overwhelmed by a sense of dread and ran back to the car yelling to Betty, "They're going to capture us." He jumped into the driver's seat and sped down the highway trying to escape the craft, which now seemed to be pursuing them. Listen, this dude was having a PTSD episode.
Okay, I don't understand.
Honestly, I firmly believe that some of this for him, depending on, we don't know what he did in World War II, where he was. We know he was in Europe, but we don't know. PTSD? Possibly?
Yeah. Depending on what he saw and did. But honestly, this is already an inconsistency. So he's telling us that he approaches it, and they're like, they tell him in his mind, stay away and stay where you are and keep looking. But then he runs, and they're like, they're trying to capture us. It's like,
no,
I thought they told you to stay. I don't. They
told you to watch.
Which is weird. Is this some kind of like weird alien voyeurism?
Like, hey, there's a chair over there in the corner. We'll be back with your wife. As
I mean, that's essentially what happened.
Alien cucking. It's the new kind of abduction. As they raced down the highway, loud rhythmic buzzing sounds began emanating from the trunk of their car. They forgot their dog in the trunk.
I was about to say, it's like, dog?
Both Betty and Barney felt a strange tingling vibration through their bodies. This was the last clear memory they had before a sudden lapse in time. When they became aware again, they found themselves 35 miles farther along the road, with only fragmented and dreamlike memories of the intervening time. Both felt disoriented, but continued driving until they reached home at dawn.
I mean, I've had that when I've, like, been sleep deprived.
I mean, they did just drive across Massachusetts, New York, Southern Ontario, and Southern Quebec, and then down through New England there. So, yeah, I'd be fairly tired myself, assuming they didn't stop somewhere in Niagara Falls or Canada.
And how many times have, like, accidentally zone out?
Oh yeah, you get tired on the road, you just zone out, you start weaving.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've gotten home and I don't realize how I got home.
Yeah, I've done that too. I work overnights, so,
and it's scary when it happens.
Like, I drive the same way every single day, so I've had it where next thing I know, I'm pulling off onto our exit to come here. I'm like, I felt like I just left work. Just crazy because I drive along with tons of semi trucks and
They're gonna be started on semi trucks.
So the Hills would later try to reconstruct the events of the night, but the missing 2 hours would remain a central mystery. Their memories were fractured and incomplete, with only faint recollections of seeing a fiery orb on the ground and vague impressions of roadblocks and figures approaching their car. The encounter left them shaken with physical and emotional after effects that would continue to haunt them. Barney, typically the more skeptical of the two, couldn't shake the sense of dread he felt when looking at the humanoid figures. While Betty's curiosity about the craft and the strange light grew into a consuming obsession. This series of events marked by the beginning of one of the most intriguing and debated UFO cases in history. A story that would take years to fully unfold through memories, hypnosis, and investigation. The mystery of what truly happened during those missing hours remains at the heart of the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. So, we're going to go through some of the quote-unquote clues
in the post-encounter.
Yeah.
We're using the word clues very liberally here.
We're doing the air quotes around them.
So, just keep in mind that nobody else saw this except their dog. And he wasn't talking.
I mean, mean, that would be an interesting concept. To see what, like, pets and stuff actually think of their owners.
Somebody calls Caesar. What, is that, isn't that his name? Caesar? What? The dog whisperer?
Oh, that guy?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Caesar Milan?
Yeah.
The yeah.
He's got bit by a few dogs a few times. So after the hills unsettling drive home from the White Mountains, their lives were never the same. While the experience of missing time and the encounter itself remained fragmented in their memories, the days and weeks following the event were marked by strange physical evidence, psychological distress, and an increasing sense of unease. These post-encounter mysteries became pivotal to the investigation of their case and continue to be key points of fascination for UFO enthusiasts and skeptics alike. Now, I'm going to say, if you did not listen to us in the first season, when we do any of these, I will refuse to say ufologists. I think it's stupid. It's people that think they're scientists. I'm not saying I don't believe in aliens. I think aliens exist. I think it would be very dumb of us to, and very small-minded of us to think we are the only beings in existence in the entire universe.
I mean, even to go further, I believe personally that Bigfoot exists, but I kind of hold the same attitude when I hear, like, I'm a Sasquatchist or whatever, these Bigfoot others. Like, first of all,
Bigfoot's not real.
Yes, it is. So is Nessie.
Okay, I believe in Nessie.
Nessie doesn't exist. It's, or at least Nessie isn't a dinosaur. But anyway, my point is that it's very, it's like you said, UFOologist.
UFOologist.
It's very hard to claim you're like an expert in something that we've literally never encountered. I believe Bigfoot exists, but we haven't really encountered it other than experiences almost similar to this, where one or two or even a small group of people in isolated locations with no real verifiable means are saying, I encountered it, or I've encountered it a number of times, so therefore I'm an expert. It's like, where'd you get your degree?
And where's your evidence?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, upon returning home, Betty noticed her dress was torn in several pieces, with the hem, zipper, and lining all damaged. The dress also had a strange pinkish powder on it, which Betty later hung on her clothesline to air out. The powder mysteriously blew away from the dress, but the dress was permanently stained and damaged. I'll tell you what that was. Alien baby juice.
Good God. Don't put that image in my head.
Over the years, Betty submitted the dress for analysis by multiple laboratories, which identified unusual chemical changes. However, no definitive explanation for the damage or the residue was ever provided.
Don't make me think of the Asgard aliens in Stargate SG-1.
No, I was thinking
Thor, Heimdall.
No, I was thinking like Marvin the Martian.
Okay, that's even worse. That is a kid show, sir.
There is some adult stuff in those shows. Barney's best dress shoes were inexplicably scuffed at the toes, despite no memory of events that could have caused the damage. Maybe you running away like a little bitch did that.
Also, who's wearing their dress shoes while they're driving and traveling?
Think of the time. Yeah. And granted, although this isn't the 40s. This is the 60s, 70s.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It seems really... Some of these clothes that they're wearing... I mean, obviously, Betty wearing a dress, that's not unusual, but why is Barney wearing dress shoes? That's kind of weird.
It's because they're good Christian people.
And honestly, I've scuffed my shoes without even realizing it.
It's because he ran away like a little bitch instead of being a man and fighting these aliens for his wife. Yeah, some veteran you are.
Wow.
Damn, dude.
I don't like Betty and Barney Hill. I don't like them at all. If they were here, I'd bitch slap both of them.
Damn, dude.
I'd bitch slap them back to World War II.
Wow.
Maybe he could actually do something. Additionally, the leather strap of the binoculars he had used to observe the craft was broken. Barney could not recall how or when this had happened, adding to the sense of disorientation and confusion surrounding the event. We made the warning at the beginning, and I had said, I believe it was last week too, and I said, I talk about Benny and Barney Hill. I don't hold back on these two.
Same with the Warrens.
Same with the Warrens. I don't like either of them.
I'm going to be working on a deep dive of the Warrens later on.
One other thing we are going to do is we have a schedule kind of put up, but we are going to cut into that schedule. We will be doing an episode or two on the lovely Casey Anthony.
Lovely my ass.
Who is on TikTok now.
No more. Oh, no. She's got banned.
Pleading for people and asking, saying that she'd be an advocate for her daughter.
For herself and her daughter and for others who were wrongfully... What was it?
Who knows? Who cares?
Exactly. I watched it just because I was curious what she said. And then she said something about her daughter. And I'm like, nope, fuck you. I'm not giving you any money. And
people wonder why I hate Florida. It's people like her. Yeah. As guess where she's from?
Florida.
So the trunk of their 1957 Chevy Bel Air had several shiny circular spots that had not been there before the encounter. Right? Somebody buffed your fucking car. When the Hills experimented with a compass near these spots, they discovered the needle would spin wildly.
Okay.
Maybe there's a magnet there somewhere.
Or maybe your compass is just crap.
Yeah. However, when the compass was moved just a few inches away, it would return to normal. This magnetic anomaly baffled them and later intrigued investigators. Although no definitive scientific explanation for these circles was found, they remain one of the most peculiar physical pieces of evidence in this case. Both Betty and Barney exhibited behaviors that seemed uncharacteristic. Betty insisted that their luggage be left near the back door instead of bringing it in the house, an action she could not fully explain. Barney felt compelled to examine his genitals in the bathroom, though he found nothing unusual, or he found nothing at all.
I mean, or that, or Betty wasn't doing her wifely duties. I mean that is the time that...
I think these people are just nuts.
And yeah.
I think one of the
no pun intended. you are what you eat.
Wow.
Oh, God.
I mean, honest to God, I think what we're seeing here, obviously I have no explanation for the quote-unquote the mysterious circles on the car, but all of this behavior... I mean, I've seen it before, people coming down from a really bad drug trip will start exhibiting manic symptoms. Like, they start weird little things, they start cropping up in their head they have to do. They go, oh, because they're coming down from that. Especially if what they took, I think, was LSD. Somebody slipped it to them somewhere between Montreal and where they first started encountering. This encounter supposedly happened. I think it could very well be with a psychedelic drug. I'm pretty sure their minds are messed up. I mean, I've never done the drug before, but from what I understand, people who take LSD or anything similar to that, even after the initial trip is over, you're still kind of experiencing side effects after, like, maybe a day or so after it.
Isn't this also around the time of MK Ultra?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Or this, at least the beginning of MK Ultra.
It would have probably been a different phase of it going on.
So yes. Probably middle.
Yeah.
Middle to end.
But it could very well, maybe. But also LSD was becoming more and more popular in the sense that it was becoming more.
Thank you, MK Ultra.
So this was right in the middle of it because MKUltra was 50-73. This was 1961.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been necessarily in the middle of it.
So but also, this is when they were expanding 53-60s. It expanded 150 plus sub projects, including universities, prisons, hospitals, and military facilities from U.S. and Canada.
So it is within the realm of possibility but
that they were unknowingly
drugged. Yes, I won't. Again, can't ever say never, especially with MK Ultra. But again, keep in mind, they're driving through rural New Hampshire. There are no real military bases there.
Well,
not
it
today,
doesn't.
Not even back then, they so. And again, LSD on its own was becoming more and more of a recreational drug.
But it also, it doesn't necessarily have to be like military or anything like that. It could have been they stopped at a diner, something happened and they had to stop at like a hospital or something like that. Like,
I think it was. I think they stopped at the diner, most likely a diner. I mean, I wouldn't think they would have said, oh, we had to stop at a doctor's office on the way between there.
Not necessarily.
It's more memorable. You're going to I would feel like you would remember stopping at a hospital more than you would remember stopping at a diner.
So, not immediately where they were, but there were several bases near them. Mm. So you had Pease, which is in Portsmouth.
Yeah.
It is, Pease was believed to be involved in UFO monitoring. That's where the B-47 Stratojets were.
Oh.
During the 60s. It was a SAC base during the Cold War.
Oh.
You had Greenier Air Force Base, which is now Manchester Boston Airport.
Okay.
That at that time was a base that was about 60 miles south of their abduction site. Okay. Which did military aviation operations. There was also New Boston Air Force Station, which is now Space Force, 25 miles southwest of the abduction site. They did radar tracking and electronic warfare testing. And then there was also a naval shipyard there in Portsmouth Naval Shipyard.
That one I know. I would assume rule out if it was MKUltra and if they were operating out of any of those bases, the one that would have probably been close to link there would have been the ones further away from there. Because remember, this all happened in the White Mountains, which is central and northern New Hampshire, which again, I still rule out MK Ultra, but again, as I said,
LSD. Yeah, but I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Oh yeah,
here.
No, because
they were the subprojects were doing LSD aerosol dispersal,
and the thing
they
is,
they were literally going spraying fucking LSD everywhere.
Yeah, who knows?
God, why couldn't I have lived back then?
And also, Air Material Command was there. Hanscom. Super. It is, but it is only an hour from Portsmouth. They could have been doing testing too. Because they are. Hanscom is a strictly research base.
Well, think about what they said. That could have been something from Pease. Could have been a classified thing from Pease. I mean, how long have we been doing classified projects?
I still
think it's the beginning of time.
I still think it was some asshole cook at a diner that laced
the
food. That to me, that is, this all reads like a bad LSD trip, loss of time and everything, and the after effects kind of fit with the manic episodes and behavior. And it just, so to me, it's like, okay, who did it? A government experiment, or was this just some asshole waiter or cook at a diner somewhere in Canada or northern New Hampshire that just decided to play fuck games with a couple going down a lonely highway?
Well, it could also be like, hey, he's black.
Whatever the motivation is.
So the Hills took unusually long showers after arriving home, describing an urgent need to cleanse themselves. The sense of contamination is often reported in modern abduction accounts, though in 1961 it was virtually unheard of. Their discomfort and compulsive behavior further fueled their belief that something extraordinary and invasive had happened to them.
Okay, the unusually long showers after arriving home. Doesn't that always happen after a long trip? You just want to take a long shower because you feel gross and like gritty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know when we drove from Wisconsin, like to Wisconsin from New York, it's like a 12 to 13 hour drive.
Think about when we moved you guys down here.
Oh, don't even. And that was only a 6 hour drive.
I still have flashbacks of that. I never want to experience that again.
In the weeks following the encounter, both Betty and Barney struggled with a growing sense of unease. Betty experienced frequent episodes of anxiety and began to suffer from recurring nightmares. Barney, who was typically stoic and pragmatic, found himself increasingly irritable and distracted. He began to develop physical symptoms, including ulcers and hypertension, which doctors attributed to stress. About 10 days after the encounter, Betty began having a series of extraordinarily vivid and detailed dreams. For five consecutive nights, she dreamed of being taken aboard a craft, separated from Barney, and subjected to medical examinations by small humanoid beings. These dreams were unlike anything she had experienced before, both in their intensity and the clarity of the details. In her dreams, the beings were described as being about 5 feet tall, with large dark eyes, bluish-gray skin, and thin lips. Betty also recalled a leader who communicated with her in English and showed her a strange star map, explaining the craft's routes through space. After the fifth night, the dreams abruptly stopped, but continued to occupy her thoughts during the day. Betty eventually wrote down the details of her dreams, which would later align with memories uncovered during hypnosis.
This hypnosis is such a reliable method of recalling memories.
As the Hills tried to piece together their journey home, they realized their trip had taken far longer than it should have. The 178-mile drive from Colebrook to Portsmouth normally took about 4 hours, but they arrived home nearly 7 hours after their departure. They could not account for 2 hours of the drive, and the last 35 miles between Lincoln and Ashland were completely blank in their memories. Both Betty and Barney recalled hearing a series of loud buzzing noises during the encounter, but their recollections beyond that were disjointed and incomplete. Betty had fleeting impressions of a roadblock and being surrounded by figures, while Barney had a vague memory of a fiery orb near the road. These scattered details only deepened their sense of confusion and made them desperate for answers. Betty, feeling a need to report what happened, contacted the Pease Air Force Base in Portsmouth. She described the encounter in detail, including movements of the craft and its proximity to their vehicle. The Air Force took her report seriously, though their official conclusion attributed the sighting to natural causes, specifically the planet Jupiter. This explanation did little to satisfy the Hills or address the missing time and physical evidence.
How the fuck was that planet Jupiter? I mean, I know it's...
Listen, all reports account them just seeing the planet Jupiter. Maybe it was their anus. I mean, Uranus.
I can imagine. I wonder who the sergeant or airman who drew the short straw that day to be like, fuck, I'm on alien call duty. Son of a bitch. Last time
Not again.
And, it's like, last time I tried and banged this first sergeant's wife.
Jeez. Whose Cheerios did I piss in?
Damn it, Jody, I gotta go.
I have to take a report on... Aliens.
Betty also contacted NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. I fucking hate NICAP. Civilian UFO Research Organization. NICAP investigator Walter Webb, fucking wacko too, conducted a 6-hour interview with the Hills, during which they recounted everything they could remember about the encounter. Webb was struck by their sincerity and the level of detail in their accounts, concluding that they were telling the truth, though certain elements remained unverifiable. And see, here's the first red flag. The level of detail in their accounts.
You shouldn't have a lot of detail.
Almost everybody before this who had an encounter didn't have a lot of detail. They just showed up somewhere butt-ass naked. They lost time. But no, not, oh yeah, I remember what they look like. They talked to me in English. They showed me a star map.
Which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
And even like later accounts didn't go into that much detail.
The Hills experiment with the compass near the shiny circles on the car trunk remains one of the most intriguing physical clues. While skeptics have suggested that the effect could be attributed to natural magnetic properties of the car or contamination from nearby objects, No definitive explanation was provided. The apparent connection between the circles and the encounter was a key focus for UFO researchers at the time. Even as they sought help from investigators and explored possible explanations, the Hills remained haunted by the gaps in their memories and the strange physical evidence. The sense that something extraordinary had happened to them was unshakable, setting the stage for deeper investigations that would eventually include hypnosis sessions to uncover their missing memories. The post-encounter period was marked by a mix of physical, psychological, and circumstantial evidence that defied simple explanation. While skeptics would later attempt to rationalize these anomalies, the combination of physical clues, behavioral changes, and fragmented memories made the Hills experience one of the most compelling UFO cases in history. The mysteries surrounding this period remain central to understanding the impact of their encounter and the lasting fascination it continues to inspire. Are you laughing at their experience?
Absolutely, 100%.
That's rude. You, how dare you make damn, them dude. Feel lesser? Wow.
What happened to... What would you do if it happened to me?
Laugh.
No. I would not laugh if you got abducted by aliens, because aliens would not abduct people. I'm sorry, but I don't see the logic in abduction. And this has always been something about alien abductions that always bothered me. Everyone else is like, why wouldn't an alien want to study humans? I was like, I just don't see the logical point in alien abductions.
So. I think they do study us, but I don't think... Maybe some people were abducted. Maybe.
I think they study us from space.
You had to throw that in there, didn't you?
Yes. At least once.
Yeah. But on a serious note, if they somehow mastered a way of interstellar travel, I'm pretty sure they don't need to go down and grab some rando person or persons and just do these whatever experiments that we would do on animals.
I mean, they probably do. Like, they can research us all they want, because
they're walking among us.
Exactly. If they have faster than light travel, what's saying that they don't have like camouflage or
what's saying they're not your doctor? Turn your head and cough. Oh, they have two balls. We have three. So the missing time from Betty and Barney Hill's encounter became a defining mystery in their lives. Despite their attempts to reconstruct the events of that September night, the two-hour gap remained unexplained. It wasn't until they turned to hypnosis in 1964, 3 years later, after the encounter, that they began to piece together their fragmented memories. However, the use of hypnosis raised many questions as it answered, with debates still ongoing about whether it revealed buried truths or inadvertently created false memories.
False memories for the win.
In the months following the encounter, Betty and Barney exhibited signs of psychological strain. Betty was plagued by vivid nightmares of being abducted, while Barney's anxiety and physical health began to deteriorate. His doctors noted symptoms of ulcers and hypertension, which they attributed to stress. Both felt increasingly uneasy about the unexplained gaps in their memory and began to suspect that something traumatic had occurred during the missing time.
And Barney being under stress, he was a mail carrier in New Hampshire during the 1960s, in an interracial relationship. I wonder where the stress is coming from.
Walter White, Webb, the NICAP investigator who interviewed the Hills, had noted the possibility of missing time during their account of the journey. This phenomenon was not well known at the time, but UFO researchers speculated that it might indicate a significant event the couple had unconsciously blocked out. Webb suggested that hypnosis, a growing psychological tool in the 1960s, might help uncover these hidden memories. The Hills sought help from Dr. Benjamin Simon, a prominent psychiatrist and neurologist based in Boston. Dr. Simon was well respected in the field of hypnosis, particularly for his work treating veterans with PTSD. He agreed to take on their case, intrigued by the sincerity and the unique nature of their story.
At this time, would it be PTSD or would it be shell shock?
No, PTSD. Shell shock. We changed it during World War II, I believe.
No, right after. Vietnam, I thought.
It was.
I thought it was still shell shock in like the Vietnam or Korean, and then they switched it to PTSD. I think it was slow, like after World War II, it was slowly becoming PTSD, but it was still known as shell shock.
Yeah, for most of the mainstream, they didn't really start definitively getting more serious until after Vietnam.
So, if we want to be correct, shell shock was only during World War I. World War II, they changed it to battle fatigue or combat stress reaction, CSR. They would call it war neurosis. Korean War, it was combat stress reaction. Vietnam was post-Vietnam syndrome. And then PTSD 1980 up till now. So we want to be right. So technically shell shock was the only...
Yeah, so 1960s, which one would it be?
1960 would have technically been post-Vietnam syndrome, but he was not a Vietnam veteran, so they would have counted it as battle fatigue because he was a World War II veteran.
Well, it's 1961. We weren't really involved like we would be.
We were starting to.
Yeah.
It was starting to slow down. We were starting to pull out.
In 61, at this point, all we had in Vietnam were military advisors to the South Vietnamese Army. In about a year or so, probably a couple of years, it would start escalating to like whole combat units being sent to Vietnam.
So because it was from World War II, they stopped calling it shell shock because doctors didn't like it because they related that with people exposed to explosions.
Yeah.
And obviously we know you can get that without that. So they start calling it battle fatigue, war neurosis, or combat exhaustion. So his would have been like battle fatigue.
Yeah.
But obviously today we call it PTSD, and unfortunately
it's a bitch.
Still an issue.
It is an absolute
Don't even
bitch.
Get me started on the VA. I can do 6 episodes on the VA itself. So Dr. Simon conducted hypnosis sessions with Betty and Barney separately to prevent them from influencing each other's recollections.
Despite the fact they're married and living in the same home.
Yeah.
And shared everything with each other.
This method allowed him to compare their accounts for consistency and provided a clear picture of their individual experiences. Under hypnosis, both Betty and Barney were guided into a relaxed state to access subconscious memories. Simon used a technique known as age regression, leading them back to the night of September 19th, 1961. The process was emotionally intense, with both subjects reliving their experiences in vivid detail. As the sessions progressed, Betty and Barney began to recount strikingly similar narratives of being taken aboard a spacecraft by humanoid beings. While their descriptions sometimes diverged in minor details, the overarching themes of their accounts were consistent, which Dr. Simon found compelling. Well, no shit, they lived together.
They lived together for 3 years, talking about it daily, most likely.
Because remember, they tried to figure this stuff out on their own before they actually called NICAP and anyone else.
Yeah. So they already had a chance to get their story straight.
Barney's hypnosis sessions revealed a deep sense of terror. He vividly described seeing humanoid figures in the windows of the craft with large wraparound eyes that seemed to penetrate his thoughts.
Anybody, this was a drug induced something from LSD, and it was squirrels.
Just wait.
He recalled being unable to look away as though the beings had a mesmerizing hold on him. their eyes. They're in my brain.
That sucks.
He said during one session, his voice trembling with fear.
I could not have been the guy that saw Benjamin Simon doing this. He'd be like, "Oh, nice, huh?"
Yeah. Barney recounted feeling compelled to drive the car off the road and stop in a wooded area. I
do that. I feel that a lot. I don't act on it.
I mean, I feel like driving it off a fucking mountain, but I don't do it. There, he described six humanoid figures approaching the vehicle. He felt paralyzed with fear as three of the beings led him out of the car and onto a ramp that extended from the craft. His memories of being inside the craft included being undressed by the beings who communicated through telepathy, lying on a short metal examination table, which was uncomfortable due to his height, and having various instruments placed on his body, including a circular device that pressed against his groin.
We need to see your small pee-pee.
I'm telling you, this guy, his wife and him were having an LSD trip, and a bunch of bears or deer or something were fucking with him while he was naked on a picnic table. I'm telling you.
What the fuck?
Think about it. They're having an LSD trip. He's like, I'm on this examination table. And there's some poor family driving up. It's like, Dad, I just want to eat my picnic. And there's some naked black guy on the table.
Barney Sessions often left him visibly distressed, sweating and trembling as he recounted the experience. Despite his skepticism about alien life, his hypnotic recollections painted a vivid and unsettling picture. Now, Betty. Betty's hypnotic memories bore striking similarities to the vivid dream she had experienced shortly after the encounter. No shit. However, her account during hypnosis included additional details and differed in certain ways, suggesting it was not entirely influenced by her prior dreams. Betty described being separated from Barney once they were aboard the craft. She interacted with a being she called the leader, who communicated with her in English. The being reassured her that no harm would come to them. Betty recalled being placed on a similar examination table and undergoing medical procedures, including the insertion of a long needle into her abdomen. The beings told her this was a pregnancy test, a concept unfamiliar to medical practices at the time. Unlike Barney, Betty seemed less afraid and more curious about the beings, even attempting to engage them in a conversation. Yeah, because she's not a bitch like Barney is. Well, she is a bitch, but one of the most remarkable elements of Betty's hypnosis sessions was her recollection of a star map. She described seeing a three-dimensional map with points of light connected by lines, which the leader explained represented trade and exploration routes. Under hypnosis, Betty reproduced the map with striking detail, which later became a central piece of evidence for proponents of their story. Funny enough, she named it herself. Dr. Simon's professional conclusion was nuanced. While he did not believe the Hills were fabricating the story, he theorized that their memories were likely shaped by psychological facts, including Betty's dreams and the stress that they were experiencing as an interracial couple in a racially turbulent time. He noted that their descriptions under hypnosis were consistent with symptoms of post-traumatic stress, though the source of the trauma remained unclear. Yeah. Simon was cautious about attributing their memories to extraterrestrial activity. Keep in mind, this guy's not a UFO believer. He is a legit psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And helps veterans. Like, this was a good dude.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he had to deal with these quacks.
Yeah, and it gave him a bad name.
Yeah.
He believed hypnosis had unlocked subconscious interpretations of real-world events. Possible misidentified stimuli such as light or aircraft. Stop short of endorsing the UFO explanation. Smart man. Yeah. Keep his business intact.
Yeah, he's like, I want to actually have a practice after this.
I want to still be able to treat veterans. And I don't personally know anybody that has done this to treat their PTSD, but I know it was a big thing in the 60s and 70s.
It was a new concept. Back then, they tended to all these fad things. They tended to just throw them at everything.
I mean, I started with my PTSD. I started EMDR. Never really finished it, but that was probably like the closest thing.
I just used alcohol.
Yeah.
It worked for me. Not really. Hypnosis was a widely accepted psychological tool in the 1960s, but it was not without controversy. Critics argued that hypnosis could create false memories, especially if the hypnotist unintentionally led the subject. In the Hills case, skeptics have suggested that their accounts may have been influenced by cultural factors, such as science fiction media or Betty's pre-existing interest in UFOs. The use of hypnosis to uncover hidden memories became a hallmark of alien abduction narratives in the decades that followed. The Hills case set a precedent, lending a veneer of scientific legitimacy to similar claims. However, it also sparked debates about the reliability of hypnosis as a method for recovering repressed memories. The hypnosis sessions conducted by Dr. Simon reveal striking and detailed accounts of the Hills' alleged abduction, but they also left lingering questions. Were these memories accurate recollections of a real event, or were they constructed by the mind to make sense of a mysterious and traumatic experience?
Or was it from a TV show called The Outer Limits that they did watch?
That's a good show. Oh, that's The Outer
Limits. I've never seen it, so I wouldn't know.
Twilight Zone, sorry.
Yeah.
Imagine the time split.
For Betty and Barney Hill, however, the sessions brought a sense of resolution, providing them with answers, however subjective, to the mystery that had haunted them for years. So, let's talk about the star map. So this is one of the biggest debated parts of this. One of the most compelling and hotly debated aspects of Betty Hill's account of her abduction was her recollection of a star map, allegedly shown to her by the beings aboard the spacecraft. This map became a central piece of evidence for proponents of the Hill story, with some interpreting it as proof of extraterrestrial contact. Over time, the map's significance has been scrutinized by astronomers, skeptics, and UFO enthusiasts alike, creating a fascinating blend of science, speculation, and controversy.
So I get yelled at for accidentally doing a double paragraph, but you don't get anything for misspeaking?
I slept for 5 hours.
I slept for like 2.
That's your fault.
No, I just ran like a... Oh, boo-hoo.
This is your job.
That's a little hard.
She did a double paragraph, a repeat, trying to make me sound stupid.
No comment. No comment. I'm not walking into that one.
I always just blame your Florida education.
No, you walk under it because everything goes over your head.
I mean, I am 5'2", so that makes sense.
So you're taller than these aliens, but does that make them their leader? Because she's taller?
No. I mean, we already said she's an alien.
No, we said Ben was the alien.
I don't look like them. You resent.
What was that? You what?
Finish your thought.
What?
Finish that thought. I double dog dare you.
You should know those don't work on me. I almost stepped on a landmine and I'm going to backtrack out of it. So, anyway.
I heard the click of the landmine. Let's as talk he stepped about on this it.
Star map from the crazy lady Benny Hill. Shall we?
Nice save.
So, as Barney Hill told his wife that she looks like an alien. I see some similarities here. Are you Barney Hill?
No.
So, I mean, Ben fought in World War II as well.
I didn't fight in World War II.
No, he fought in the Colosseum as a gladiator.
Don't give him that much credit.
Wow.
Jeez. God, don't give him that much credit.
I fought in the Colosseum. You don't know.
Okay,
I'd say win, but
what's the earliest war?
Trojan.
Yeah. The war between good and evil. Wow. He was the snake in the Garden of Eden.
He's not Satan.
Yeah, the Trojan War would have been the first major war. Ben was in the head of the Trojan horse.
Okay. The earliest recorded war was between the Sumerians and the... I'm going to butcher this. Don't say shit. ELAMITES. Around 27,000 BCE in Mesopotamia.
No idea. Funny enough, though, a lot of Sumerian mythology is connected with UFOlogy.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Off track again. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, it's painful. Under hypnosis, Betty reproduced. Stop fucking flipping us off. Betty, this show is made for kids. Betty reproduced the star map from memory. The map can. It's convenient. She can't remember other things, but she can. Produce a fucking star map from memory. The map consisted of 12 prominent stars connected by straight lines. Additional stars in the background. Betty claimed that the lead did not name any of the stars, but pointed out the location of her sun and the being's home star. The precise and structured arrangement of the map intrigued both researchers and skeptics, sparking a search to determine if it corresponded to any known star system. Guess what? It didn't.
And also, why would they just randomly show the person they've abducted? Hey, by the way, we live here.
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing. So this gets called the Zeta Reticuli system. I believe.
Yes.
Well, it's what it appears to look like, the Zeta Reticuli.
Yeah.
That's a system like 39 light years from us. Why'd you choose one that far out? So nobody can
verify our story.
So talk about Marjorie Fish for a minute. Marjorie Fish was an elementary school teacher and amateur astronomer who became captivated by the Hill's story after reading John G. Fuller's The Interrupted Journey. Fascinated by the star map, Fish set out to determine whether it represented a real vantage point in the universe. Fish painstakingly created a three-dimensional model of nearby stars using beads and thread, basing her work on the stellar distances published in the 1969 Gliese Star Catalog, or Gliese Star Catalog. She assumed that the beings were from a star system with characteristics similar to our sun, such as temperature, luminosity, and the potential for habitable planets. After studying her model from various vantage points, Fish identified a possible match. The map appeared to align with the Zeta Reticuli system, a binary system located approximately 39 light years from Earth in the constellation Reticulum. Fish proposed that the beings who abducted Betty and Barney Hill originated from one of two stars, Zeta 1 Reticuli or Zeta 2 Reticuli. Easy.
Didn't she have other better things to do, like, you know, educating the youth of America?
No.
Nope.
So her identification of Zeta Reticuli were based on the following factors. The stars were similar in size and luminosity to our sun, making them candidates for hosting life-supporting planets. The arrangement of stars in the region closely matched Betty's sketch when viewed from a specific angle in space. The pattern of lines connecting the stars on Betty's map corresponded to trade and exploration routes in Fish's interpretation. Okay, so Fish knew the trade routes?
I was about to say, like, how is she an alien? That's a shame.
Or is she a lizard person?
She's a fish person. Quite literally, it's in her name.
But lizard people, that's another one that is a little
out there.
Oh yeah, supposedly all of our world leaders are lizard people And the Queen of England was supposedly the head lizard person.
I mean, look at what happened. She passed away, and now, yeah.
What?
All old people are lizard people.
Yeah. I mean, they look like it.
Yeah. So, wow, you're admitting that your hero was a lizard person? Maggie Smith was a lizard person?
No.
She was the only
She was one. A lizard cat.
Starfleet?
So, Fish's findings were sent to Walter Webb, the original NICAP investigator, who found her conclusions compelling. Of course he did. The map was later popularized in UFO literature as potential evidence of extraterrestrial contact. While some researchers found Fish's interpretation intriguing, many astronomers were skeptical. One of the most vocal critics was Carl Sagan, who argued that the map's alignment with real stars was coincidental. Sagan pointed out that the dots on the map could represent any number or random alignments. Humans have a natural tendency to find patterns even when none exist, a phenomenon known as pareidolia. And without connecting the lines, the resemblance to real star systems diminished significantly.
Carl Sagan, just to let you all know, very famous astrophysicist. He was the mentor to Dr.
Don't we have some of his books?
Yes.
I think we have a couple.
We have a few of his books sitting right over there.
He's also the mentor for Dr.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah.
We have a few of his books, too.
Exactly.
I mean, some of the brightest minds in history.
Carl Sagan also was a fairly... I believe he also believed in aliens. He just was very logical about it. Many of these early belief proponents of UFOs were really out there about it. Sagan always kept his beliefs rooted in science and logic. I don't think he ever really believed that aliens who found a way to travel between stars would just bother with our planet to just because.
Yeah, so I was looking at it. So he believes, like we do, that because the universe is so vast, the odds of life existing elsewhere are extremely high.
Yes.
He wrote a book called Intelligent Life in the Universe with a Soviet astronomer, Iosif Shklovsky, discussing the likelihood of extraterrestrial civilizations. He supported projects like the Viking missions to Mars and the Voyager Golden Record, designed to communicate with potential alien civilizations. So he doubted a lot of UFO and alien abduction claims.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, aliens have the ability to travel between stars and everything. If they're going to make contact with humans or anything, a species that is lesser than them, because let's face it, we are lesser. We would be lesser advanced civilization compared to a species that somehow figured out a way to get between star system A to star system B. I would figure they either treat us like animals, which in that case they wouldn't care about whether they see us or not, because again, when National Geographic photographers and other scientists go out into the oceans and the savannas of Africa to studies, do they really care if an animal really sees them? No. I mean, they know to avoid them so they don't get killed or hurt, but ultimately they don't care because they're dealing with animals. So if an alien civilization is going to Earth to have peaceful intentions, they're going to make contact. Or yep. if it's nefarious, like, oh, they look at us,
we're going
like,
to war.
Hmm?
We're going to war.
Yeah.
I believe aliens exist. I believe they're so far out there that unless we start pulling a Star Trek, we will never see them. Not in our lifetime. We won't see them.
No.
Maybe in our grandkids or great-grandkids' lifetimes, they'll see them. But in our lifetime, we won't. Carl Sagan did the Arecibo message, which was the radio signal in 74 that was sent to space to try and communicate with aliens. And then he helped create the Voyager Golden Record.
Oh,
which was the time capsule that was sent on Voyager that had sounds, images, and greetings in 55 languages. So Carl Sagan was all involved in that.
Well, if we go by Star Trek, we should have first contact with Vulcans on April 5th, 2063.
We'll all be old and in a nursing home when that'll happen.
Well, or dead because they had the nuclear war with World War III.
That too.
So in the early 1990s, data from the European Space Agency's Hipparco satellite provided more accurate measurements of stellar distances. This updated data revealed that some of the stars identified by Fish were much farther away than previously thought, undermining the validity of her model. Additionally, some of the stars Fish deemed likely candidates for hosting life were found to have characteristics that made them less suitable, such as variability or binary systems with unstable planetary orbits, meaning gravity comes in and out, and you could literally fall off the planet.
That would suck.
Yeah. Especially if you're like Earth and it's flat. Proponents of Fish's work argue that the specific arrangement of stars on the map was highly unlikely to occur by chance. David Saunders, a statistician, that's so hard to say.
It is.
Who works on the Condon UFO study, claimed that the odds of the map aligning with 16 nearby stars of the same spectral type were at least 1,000 to 1 against coincidence. Skeptics countered that such analysis often relied on selective criteria and subjective interpretation.
Meaning that you can look at the data and just see what you wanted to see, which is pretty what much. A UFOologist would see. They would be like, oh, it can't be a coincidence. I was like, or it can be.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a saying that there's no such thing as coincidences, but
I think there is a limit to that.
I mean, yeah. I believe there's no such thing as coincidences when you come to like an investigation,
as
law enforcement. That the Zeta Reticuli connection became a cornerstone of the Hill's case and was widely cited in UFO literature as evidence of extraterrestrial visitation. It contributed to the rise of the Greys as popular depiction of alien beings associated with advanced starfaring civilizations. The map also inspired numerous documentaries, books, and debates about the possibility of intelligent life in the Zeta Reticuli system, which, again, we won't reach the Zeta Reticuli system in our lifetime.
No. Yeah, for quite some time.
Some critics suggested that the star map was influenced by Betty's exposure to astronomy or cultural ideas about space exploration. They argued that her subconscious mind could have constructed the map based on a combination of dreams, scientific imagery, and her interest in UFOs.
Most likely.
For many, the star map remains a symbol of the Hills' sincerity and the potential for their experience to have been real. It represents a tantalizing possibility that intelligent life exists somewhere in or elsewhere in the universe that has visited Earth. The precision of Betty's recollection and the initial alignment with real stars continue to intrigue believers. For skeptics, the star map is a cautionary tale about the risks of confirmation bias and the limitations of memory. It highlights how human perception and interpretation can shape seemingly extraordinary evidence into something meaningful, even when the underlying reality is ambiguous. Today, the Zeta Reticuli system remains a topic of speculation among UFO enthusiasts, but no evidence of habitable planets or intelligent life has been discovered there. Advances in exoplanet detection and stellar analysis may eventually provide more context, either reinforcing or further discrediting Fish's interpretation. The star map is perhaps the most enduring piece of evidence in Betty and Barney Hill's case, whether viewed as genuine artifact of extraterrestrial contact or a product of human imagination. It continues to provoke questions about the nature of memory, the search for meaning, and humanity's place in the universe. Now, that's where we're going to end this episode. We will come back with public relation and kind of wrap everything up.
That's going to be a short episode, probably about like a half hour or so.
Yeah, we'll kind of wrap all of that up.
And also give our interpretations of what we feel.
Yeah, and then we'll kind of go into a little more discussion of, because each of us, obviously, we've said each of us believe aliens exist. We just, some people have different reasons why we've never seen them, or
I mean, I know I do.
Yeah, I mean, because you have the they've never actually been here. They live on a different. They're here, but they live on a different plane of existence. Blah 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 blah.
We kind
of
went a little bit
into. Doesn't like that one.
Yeah. I know we went into a little bit when we were doing the like the UFOs, the Grays, all of that. Well,
that earlier. Other plane of existence one is really big on Skinwalker Ranch, which my favorite.
Which we are going to be redoing.
Yes, we are.
I
wish we could visit.
Hell to the fuck no.
And it's privatized. Good. But yeah. So, that's it. Thank you everybody for listening, and visiting Scarlet Tavern. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.